Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction and fantasy. I am your host, Beverly Prentice. I hope you enjoy the program. If so, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Time Curves by Kate Rauner. The heavy metal door swung open on creaking hinges, and Michael took a step away from his lab bench, careful not to jostle any equipment, before turning toward the interloper. His wife, Abby, stopped at the lab door. She always complained about his unshielded experiments and stood far away. Michael, still hard at it? He started a deep breath, but it burned in his chest, and he suppressed a cough that would only lead Abby to fuss. "I thought you were going to a movie tonight." "I did. It's over. Are you ready to come home?" He tugged at his worn white coat in irritation. "I can't. I taught late classes and only started a little while ago. I'm almost ready to run the first test." "On your closed time curve? So you can violate the Heisenberg uncertainty principle?" She slumped against the doorframe. "But your own thesis showed that's impossible." "My thesis presented a Dooschian closed-time curve to satisfy the PhD committee. I was forced to assume a particle would emerge in a universe different from the one where it began, here." He swept a hand to the bench. "But a particle can skip into the future and return to its own universe. Finally, I have the freedom to study what I want when I'm not interrupted." Abby ignored his hint to leave. "What about tomorrow? It's our anniversary. You promised." Michael's jaw clenched. There'd be plenty of time for movies and dinners once he'd proven his hypothesis. Still, Abby knew more about his goals than the ossified old farts who ran the department. Conventional theories allowed traveling backwards along a time curve, so no one objected to studying that paradigm. But his inspiration would allow travel forwards. His speculative model troubled the review committee, though they hadn't tried to shut him down. They couldn't afford to ignore the possibility. If he was right, it would be the greatest discovery in physics in a century. His name would rival Einstein, Bohr, and Schrödinger. So the university assigned Michael a lab, even as they loaded him with a junior professor's heavy teaching schedule. But the muttering against him continued. He had to produce some promising results, and soon. What was Abby saying? Something about their anniversary? Yeah, sure. He hoped she'd be placated and leave, so he plastered a best charming smile on his face. "We'll have dinner at that little Mexican place you like." "Senior Tees? It closed 6 months ago." The metal door slammed as Abby left. Not an ideal end to the conversation, but at least she was gone. Michael knew his concept was correct. It was the equipment that remained marginal, hard to calibrate and hard to control. He dragged his old laptop across the bench, tapped a button, and the racks at the end of the lab hummed to life. As the equipment warmed, he pulled the metallic saucer close and plugged in two short cables. Maybe he had been working too hard. His eyes felt hot and swollen, and he rubbed them with the heel of one hand and dropped his other to lean on the bench. His vision was blurry when he tapped the keyboard. A blue flash blinded him. Pain lanced through his hand. Michael shrieked and fell backwards as blood sprayed across the bench. The door burst open, and two wide-eyed men tumbled through, lanky foreign exchange students tripping over their own feet. "Dr. Fisher, what the hell?" Michael knelt on the floor, cradling his arm. Someone pushed a towel against the gushing wound. More people arrived, and voices surrounded him. "What set off the alarms? Damn it, where are his fingers? We should take them with us. I don't see them. We can't wait. He's bleeding." Through a woozy fog, his hand throbbed on the ride to the hospital. Darsh added plexiglass shields around the equipment, moved the laptop across the aisle to a counter under the windows, and secured long cables along the floor with heavy layers of duct tape. He was patient, competent, and exactly the sort of postdoc assistant the department safety officer insisted Michael take on. He had no choice if he wanted to continue his work. Michael had searched the lab thoroughly and found no trace of his missing fingers. They must have skipped on a time curve, but his thrill faded to frustration. The computer hadn't been recording, and he couldn't reproduce the effect. What he needed was a reflector coated with osmium, even a single atom thick, to improve control. Darsh was clearing notepads off the experimental bench when a blue flash. Michael leaped backward. "Darsh, you idiot, who told you to hit the key?" "I didn't touch it, sir." Clearly he hadn't. The laptop lay on the counter behind him, but Darsh wasn't looking at the computer. Blood trickled across papers on the bench where something beige had appeared. Two fingers sliced off below the first knuckle. Michael crept up on the fingers as if they were alive. Maybe they still were. Blood oozed out. It worked. "My fingers came forward in time. It worked!" Michael roared in triumph. For the second time in a month, Abby raced to the hospital, urging AutoCab to drive faster as she read and reread Michael's message. "Meet me at ER. Don't fuss. Good emergency." She was interrogating the admissions clerk when he called to her from across the room. She ran to him. "Michael, thank God." "I've seen the doctor already." He held up his damaged hand. "The stumps are too far healed for them to reattach my fingers, but the fingers are fresh. Look." He held up a plastic bag, and Abby's knees gave out. Michael was helping her to a chair when someone called his name. A tech in blue scrubs braced the inner door open with one foot as he read from a clipboard. "Dr. Fisher, this way, please. We can run your imaging now." That brought Abby full awake. "What imaging?" Michael shrugged. "Just following up on an anomaly from my last visit." Heat rose through Abby's cheeks. He hadn't told her about any problem. There'd been a time when they shared everything, good and bad. It wasn't long before he returned. "The doctor will have the results soon, so we can talk to him in a minute. Hospital waiting rooms must be the last place on earth with paper magazines." He picked one up idly, avoiding her eyes. Once the doctor said cancer, Abby didn't remember most of his words. There was advanced and inoperable and something about trials. The word terminal was in there, too. Michael was eerily calm and asked all the questions Abby's mind couldn't form. "I'm not going to waste the time I have left," he said on the ride home. Abby nestled against him, still numb. This couldn't be true. They were sitting at the apartment's breakfast bar when Michael's phone beeped a text. His mouth crooked up in a smile as he read. "Who is it?" Abby asked. "Darsh. He talked to the Japanese. They can deposit a one-atom thick layer of osmium on a steel substrate." His eyes glowed as he held up the phone, wagging it back and forth. With this, I still have a chance. His face hardened with fierce determination. Hun, you should be resting. She stroked his arm. Have you called the people running that medical trial yet? Michael jerked away. Their statistics are terrible. I'm not going to waste time grasping at straws when I can accomplish real work. Abby reached for him, but he was already entering a reply, tapping with the fingers on his good hand. Abby came to the lab as quickly as she could. Michael's message woke her long before dawn, but she came. He was working at his usual bench, but balanced on a stool now, too tired to stand. His clothes hung loosely on his withering frame. Darsh looked up as Abby entered. "Sorry to wake you at this hour. May I get you something? The coffee's actually fresh. It's our third pot." Abby hadn't noticed the assistant's shy smile or his kind dark eyes before. Michael never worried about her comfort in the lab. "I've done it." Michael looked up wearily. "I can send something into the future. Anything that will fit in the paraboloid." He pointed a truncated finger at a large bowl, shimmering silvery blue and mounted sideways on a pedestal as if it were a chair. A potted geranium sat at its center. "I sent this flower 2 weeks ago, and it came through tonight. The petals are still fresh, the soil still damp. I can control the effect." Triumph wiped the exhaustion from his face for a moment. "I wanted you to see." "I'll arrange for an independent review of the calculations in the morning," Darsh said. "Let me download a copy." "They're on my tablet. It's under the window somewhere." He waved Darsh away to a pile of papers in the corner. Michael slipped his tablet from his lab coat's wide pocket and handed it to Abby. "The password is Abby," he whispered. "But isn't Darsh looking for this?" "Hush! Promise me you'll do exactly as I say." He waved to a nearby stool. "You'll sit there. My instructions are in the files." Beneath hollow eyes, Michael's attempt at a charming smile was ghastly. He dragged a wireless keyboard to the edge of the bench and sat in the paraboloid. "I'm going to see my work published, see my name become famous." He kicked off his shoes and lifted his feet into the dish, hugging his shins tight with one arm. "Behold my magic wand." Michael reached to the bench and picked up three or four pencils taped together end to end. "I'm counting on you, Abby." He poked the keyboard. A blue flash filled the room. Darsh shouted, "No, no." An after image of orange blobs crawled in front of Abby's eyes, and when her vision cleared, Michael was gone. Darsh activated a monitor under the windows. Lines spanned the display with regularly spaced spikes. He skipped ahead. Abby gawked at the display, gulping helplessly as Darsh brushed the screen with a thumb and finger. The graph zoomed out until a dozen spikes showed. The words "tachyon energy" ran up the y-axis and "time" along the X. She finally found words. "When will Michael be back?" The assistant frowned at the screen. "I can't tell from this file. He used high power. We never tried that before." Abby remembered the tablet clutched in her hand. "I have his notes." They stayed in the lab the rest of the night. Abby tried to amuse herself on her phone while Darsh hunkered over the computers. Dawn brightened the windows and the hall outside began to echo with chatter. "I must go to the chairman's office and explain what happened," Darsh said. "You should go home and get some sleep. What about Michael? Darsh adjusted the graph scale on the monitor and pointed to the black line across the bottom. This is the interval between tachyon events and points where Dr. Fisher's time curve will intersect our own. 130 days, maybe a few hours. I'll need the help to understand his calculations before I can be sure. 100 days? He'll starve. Our time curves have different shapes. Darsh tapped the screen, and a second chart appeared with a red line along the top that plunged in a downward spike. This is how Dr. Fisher is experiencing the effect. Here, when we see an instantaneous flash, 2 hours pass for him, and while we wait 130 days, it's an instant for him. Darsh resized the chart. The red line went on forever, diving to the X-axis at regular intervals. Abby's fingertips prickled and she staggered. Darsh took her elbow to steady her. This can't be happening, she said. 130 days later, shortly before midnight, Abby pushed open the lab door. She carried a picture of her new cat. She'd always wanted a cat, but Michael hated them. Well, she wasn't going to live alone. He'd have to get used to Muffin. You sit here. Darsh guided her to a chair facing the paraboloid dish and handed her a copy of Quantum Physics Today. On the cover, the authors of the featured paper were named in prominent type, Dr. Michael Fisher and Dr. Darsh Patel. Something's different, Abby said. The paraboloid rested on a box instead of its old pedestal. You're very observant. Dr. Fisher is skipping through time, like a stone across a pond. I can't influence his vector, but by placing the dish on this unit, I should be able to get a mass reading. He frowned. I hope the manifestation lasts long enough to measure. Flutters filled Abby's stomach. Won't Michael simply step out of the paraboloid? Be back with us? Like his fingertips or the potted geranium? Not until energy injected into the system dissipates. Darsh rubbed his forehead. Dr. Fisher and this lab exist in two separate time curves spiraling around each other, overlapping at an angle. Think of it that way. One intersection won't collapse them into a single reality. Abby plopped into her chair with Muffin's picture in Quantum Physics Today facing the paraboloid. So that's why you asked me to bring a picture showing news from home. But why would Michael appear in the lab at all? We must be a million miles from where he disappeared. Earth's orbiting the sun, and the entire solar system moves through the galaxy. The phenomenon stays within a specified frame of reference. Darsh's frown deepened. I think it's a gravitational effect. The math department is going through Dr. Fisher's calculations, but there's an unbalanced infinity somewhere. He dragged a couple flip charts into place beside her, flipping open copies of the physics journal to them. A computer began beeping. Let's see how well Dr. Fisher predicted the intersection. Darsh hurried to stand behind Abby and raised his hand to wave. Flash! Intense blue light and then orange spots danced across Abby's vision. Is that it? She asked. Darsh hurried to the computer. Within 25 nanoseconds. And look at the mass reading. Michael was really there? He beamed at her. Something was there. Isn't it wonderful? No, it's not. Abby jumped up and banged into the flip chart. You were supposed to keep him safe. She kicked the chart over. Fist clenched, she looked down at the scattered pages. How could he do this to me? Why couldn't he just die like a normal human being? Abby sat thoughtfully the next time, seated before more journals popped out, open on flip charts, while waiting for the flash. Darsh sat next to her, and two postdocs hovered over equipment on the bench below the dark windows. The university had assigned more researchers to Michael's discovery. "How's Muffin?" Darsh asked. "How sweet of you to remember. He's doing well. Runs my life. I've always liked cats." "What I said last time," she hung her head. "I wasn't fair at all. None of this is your fault." He blushed. "I never blamed you." "Darsh, do you think Michael's still alive?" "We can't be sure." "We" meant the gaggle of assistants. Darsh was principal investigator now, and in a flurry of excitement, the university gave him all the support he requested. "We've sent chronometers ahead in 1 week skips. That was successful. Most of the rats survived, too." "Most?" Abby was afraid to ask. "Can you bring Michael back?" "I'm sorry, Abby." Darth shook his head. "It's not even theoretically possible." The postdocs hunched nervously over their screens. Darth straightened in his seat. "Almost time." Abby knocked journals off the flip chart and grabbed a nearby pen. "Everything you wanted is here," she scribbled. "Come back. Tell us how to get you back." For the first manifestation in the new year, Abby arrived with a turkey sandwich, two brownies, and a bottle of water. "Where is everyone?" she asked. "The energy level of each event seems to be dropping," Darsh said. "We need more precise equipment, which requires more space and more electrical currents. The controls are installed in the next room, and the staff is monitoring from there." He pointed to a row of cameras mounted on the wall. Abby smiled weakly and waved. "You look tired," Darsh said. "Are you okay?" "I haven't been sleeping well." Abby pulled an instrument card over to the paraboloid. "We don't know if Michael can interact with our reality," Darsh said as she laid out the food. "In the tablet, he wrote that he'd be able to see me. And you think he can read these?" She waved at journals displayed on the flip charts behind her. "Which means you think our photons strike his eyes. That's an interaction." "Not exactly in the way I mean. Flash, after image." The food sat untouched on the cart. "Maybe it was too far away," Abby said. She picked up the brownies with a sigh. She handed one to Darsh. "No reason to waste these. I made them myself." His smile warmed her, pushing some of the gloom away. The next time, Abby placed a water bottle in the paraboloid and a sandwich and brownies, laid close against the side so Michael wouldn't sit on them, if that made sense. She added a paper and a pen. Darsh peered over her shoulder. "What's that?" She unfolded the sheet reluctantly and showed him. "Please tell me if you're okay." "I'm sorry if I'm being silly." "Not at all," Darsh said. "You're a caring person." He pulled a pen from his pocket and added an equation below Abby's message with question marks below a few terms. "The last manifestation was more than 10 minutes late." He returned the items to the paraboloid. "We could use his help with these calculations." Abby always stared straight to where Michael would be, so the flash left orange after images crawling across her vision. Her tears went only due to the bright light. The sandwich, brownies, and water had disappeared, but there was nothing added to the paper. Darsh had been looking forward to Abby's visit for days and called out a greeting when she opened the lab door. "I read that you're head of the physics lab now," she said. "Congratulations." He flushed, flattered. While never a cutting-edge physicist, it turned out he was a superb administrator. Abby sat in her chair. I read an article about a Paley High School class sending time capsules into the future. The kids seemed hyped about it. The university was pleased with the attention that article received, Darsh said. Most media lost interest when they realized we'll never acquire anything that originates on another time curve, but with this new design, we expect someday to reliably retrieve what we send forward. But not Michael. I'm sorry that was thoughtless of me. His chest tightened. He'd been hoping Abby would stay to talk, and if he upset her, she might hurry away. Sandwiches, flash, after image, empty paraboloid. Darsh led Abby to the window bench and reached a hand into the 3D diagram hovering there. Michael's drift is accelerating. This manifestation was 32% weaker and 2 hours later than the last one. The margin of error in our calculations is growing, too. Still can't do the math? She asked. Darsh dropped his gaze apologetically. Abby gave his arm a comforting squeeze. Hey, look, tonight's sort of an anniversary. Our 10th manifestation. Do you like breakfast burritos? I found a new Mexican place a block off campus. Abby and Darsh sat quietly together until well beyond the margin of error, but no blue light flashed. Where is he now? Abby asked as she shoved sandwiches back into a sack. I don't know. We still haven't gotten the math worked out, but... Darsh turned to look her squarely in the face. The time curves have diverged. You don't have to come back again. So, he's gone. Abby wiped away a lone tear. It's been so long, I didn't think I'd feel anything. I'll miss your visits, Darsh said sadly. Don't worry. You won't have to miss me. She bent close and kissed him. Cities Always Sleeping by Millie Ory. Winnie didn't know what a city was like. She asked me about them one night, her voice floating up from the bottom bunk in the darkness, drowning in the sea of cricket song. The windows were open, like they were every evening. We might as well have been sleeping out in the swamp, for all the noise. Leaves rustled as frogs trilled to one another, and the heavy air vibrated with the wings of moths and mosquitoes. But we were safe from them. The screens were closed. The sounds of the marsh were our lullaby. They also hid conversations from Aunt Beth's sharp ears. "Dunno, never been to one," I muttered, turning over. The springs squealed beneath me. "Okay, but what do you think they're like?" "Lots of people," I said, "lots of cars." "That's not what I meant." "Then say what you mean next time." She paused, and somewhere in the marsh a bullfrog bellowed. "I meant, why can't we go there?" This time I was silent. "Luz?" "I don't know, Winnie. Go to sleep." Winnie was up a lot at night. Sometimes I could hear her moving around in the kitchen in the wee morning hours. I wondered if it came from being blind. When I closed my eyes, I saw black. I had no idea what Winnie saw. I was about to ask her, when her voice hissed up at me again. "I know you've talked to Aunt Beth." "No, I haven't." My tone was a little bitter, and she heard it. I'd asked Aunt Beth about the cities lots of times. She always made some stupid answer about the importance of getting your hands dirty and really living, and how cities weren't good for that sort of thing. Aunt Beth knew a lot about farming, not much about kids, though. I thought about cities a lot, I knew about the traffic, the people, the weird clothes they wore, and I knew a lot about cities from the past. New York City, Sofia, Beijing, San Francisco. "Where's the closest one?" Winnie asked, and I could hear her yawn. "Long ways away." "How far?" She didn't need to know, but I told her anyway. 400 miles round trip. She scoffed. "Heck, I thought it'd be farther. I could get there on the ASV in 3 hours. I had thought that before, too. The whole bed creaked and bounced as she rolled over. "How do you know this stuff?"
"Books."
"You gotta read them to me, Luz. I gotta know this stuff." This time I scoffed. The cricket song swelled. If Aunt Beth found out we were ever talking about cities, boy, would we be in bog water. If she ever found out that 2 days after Winnie's questions, I snuck out at 2300 to unplug the ASV from its battery, she would exile me to the marshlands forever. The ASV was old, older than I was. It ran pretty smoothly, though. You couldn't get much height out of it anymore, but it was still real fast. My brother Ethan had installed a GPS thing in it and called it Sal. The name stuck. The marsh grass flattened as I tore over the fields, and in the bog places the water rippled underneath me. The humming of the engine drowned out the marsh noises. The night was pitch black. The shadows were eerie, long, and otherworldly in the headlights. Gradually, the familiar swampland turned to open meadows, and in the wide sky, I could actually make out 2 stars. Usually, I could only see the one. Dreaded light pollution. Meadows turned to dark roads, real old ones that had probably been used back before air suspension vehicles had been a thing, back when they used old rubber and rusty hunks of metal to get around. This was our border. This was the line we were never, ever supposed to cross, this back road. My hands felt chill and my face as hot as I sped over it. 3 hours is exactly one heck of a drive, especially at 1 o'clock in the morning when your eyelids are drooping and you have to force yourself not to fall asleep at the handlebars. It's even worse when it's 2 and you realize the gravity of what you've just done. I had to stop for a minute in the middle of the woods to gather my thoughts, and by gathering my thoughts, I really meant forcing myself to breathe really hard 5 or 6 times until I felt the oxygen swelling my brain. What did I do? I was alone, in the dark, farther from the farm than I had ever been in my life. What did I do? Aunt Beth was asleep. Winnie was asleep. Ethan was asleep. What did I do? I could be killed right now. I could drop dead in the middle of nowhere and no one would ever know. Alternatively, I could be killed in the city. And then I would definitely be killed at home when Aunt Beth inevitably woke and realized I was gone and the screen had been popped out of the bedroom window. Poor Winnie. She would get so many mosquito bites and then she would kill me too. Winnie. If I was going to die anyways, I might as well figure out what a city was like so my last words could be ones describing that great mystery of life to my distraught sister. The GPS chirped. You are 3 minutes from your destination. Thanks, Sal. The sound of my own voice made me feel less alone. I revved the engine and tucked my helmet back on over my braids. The lights from Torpor came into view only 30 seconds later. bright white, illuminating everything. My eyes burned from the sheer fluorescence of it all. The woods stopped in a straight line, like the trees were afraid to approach the huge expanse of glowing buildings. All the pictures of NYC's skyline couldn't have prepared me for the height of these skyscrapers. They reached into the sky, pierced it like a needle. The clouds around them glowed. Crazy. If this was the sole reason Aunt Beth kept us away from these places, I didn't blame her. I followed the road. It had become a paved one a while back, but I hadn't noticed when up to a shiny chain-link fence. Torpor was still miles away, shining like a bluish-tinted candle on the plain. I fiddled with the little lock on the gate and decided it wasn't worth the effort to pick it. I could lift Sal over the fence anyway. It took some heavy lifting and some awkward maneuvering, but I managed to get Sal safely on the other side. Leaping the pathetic gate, it was just another border to cross, really. And my success over the first one still had me elated. I hopped on and rode up to the city, my eyes watering. "Arrived," Sal said. Riding through the outskirts, I passed my first houses, if that's what they really were. They looked nothing like the cabin back home. For one thing, they were gray and awfully drab-looking. Each one had a garden, a little tree growing out front, and a little house beside the big one. Garages for the ASVs and other vehicles, I guessed. Some of the flowers on the lawns were beautiful, bright, and flourishing like the plants in the swamp. Others were dead. There were a few other mobiles on the road, all the fancy kind, which sat six and had a roof and a real steering wheel instead of handlebars. Why stay out so late at night? Was that a city folk thing? Darkness was for sleeping. But then again, I guess they never really had darkness and torpor. I rode past the suburbs and into the heart of the city. Signs. There were lots of signs. And noises. Voices coming from everywhere. Every wall, every building. Mobiles began to crowd the streets. Mine was the only one exposed to the night air. All the others at tops. They shrieked their horns at me when the lights ahead flashed red, and I sped past. Turns out red lights mean ASVs are going to swing out at you. I learned that real quick. Red, stop. Green, go. Someone honks, jump out of your seat, spin around, and find the culprit staring back at you from behind with the blankest expression you have ever seen. It was the same face Ethan made when I asked him about quantum mechanics, just to mess with him. That was how the script went. For all the angry noises they were making, city folk were pretty calm. Then some idiot in a four-seater veered out into the road ahead and crashed into the mobile right in front of me. The screech and clash of metal was deafening. The car ahead dropped to the pavement, the air suspension destroyed. I braked, sliding to a halt right before hitting the hunk of wrinkled steel in front of me. "Hey!" I screamed, yanking off my helmet and jumping off Sal. "Hey! Are you okay?" The man in the crushed mobile waved a hand weakly out the window as the idiot scooted off. I shrieked after him, but he disappeared in the glowing traffic. What was I supposed to do? I ran over to the twisted vehicle where the man's hand was still swaying back and forth. The mobiles behind us honked and zoomed by. "Are you okay?" I repeated, yelling through the open window near the sidewalk. "Hey, are you hurt?" The man lay in the driver's side. hat hid his face from view. His arm had gone limp. I feared the worst and longed for the comfort of my bed at home. In the ocean of swamp sounds and darkness, for the quiet morning hours when Winnie got up to make herself a snack. Was she awake now? Did she know I was gone? Was she whispering questions up to my empty blankets, climbing up the ladder, feeling the abandoned bed, running to Aunt Beth, to Ethan, sprinting out to the barn, the empty barn where the ASV was supposed to charge? The hat shifted. The man's head turned. There was a little blood running down his forehead. "Are you okay?" I asked again. "I'm fine," the man said, and he simply blinked at me. "I mean, it hurts, but I'm okay. I need to call someone. Hang on, okay? I'll get help." I climbed up off the sidewalk. I didn't even realize I had been kneeling, and faced the nearest building. Was it an apartment, maybe? Surely someone there would have a telephone. Surely I could ring the police. "Hey, little girl," someone called. Not the man in the ASV. He had gone quiet. It was a woman's voice. "What's with all the noise?" I searched the face of the building to find the speaker. A tall woman, standing on the third floor balcony, her hair dark and loose. "Help!" I called up to her. "Girl, you're being way too loud," she yelled back, leaning against the balcony railing. "Are you off your meds?" "I don't know what you're talking about." She was off a rocker for sure, but all I could do was hope she would help me. "Do you have a phone? Can you call an ambulance?" "Why?" I stared up at her, dumbfounded. "He's hurt." I gestured to the car. "I'm fine," the man called from inside. "He's fine," the woman said, and she disappeared into her apartment. "Take your pills tomorrow," she laughed, closing the glass door behind her. I turned to the man. "You're not fine." I poked my head in through the window. "Where's the hospital?" "Two blocks from here. But hey, it's my time." I blinked. "What? My time to go." "No, it's not. Don't be an idiot," I prodded his shoulder. He shook me off. "Let me be." I wanted to go home. I wanted Aunt Beth. The man faded out of consciousness. "Help me," I screeched, and some pedestrians walking by heard me and jumped. "Help me." How many people passed by? 30? What were they doing out so late at night, unbothered by the lights and the noise and the injured man on the side of the road? "Hey, girl, calm down," the man said, suddenly waking up. He began inching towards the open window. I panicked. "No, stay still." "No," he returned in a perfectly normal tone of voice. "I'm going home." He opened the ASV door and shuffled out onto the sidewalk as a gaggle of teenagers passed. His head was still bleeding. I was powerless to stop him. He stood up and marched on, down the pavement, limping. I was left with the shell of a mobile and a face sticky with tears. No anger, no sadness, only blank expressions. I was surrounded by aliens. They couldn't be human. "Hey," someone poked me in the back. I whirled around and found a boy standing behind me. "Are you okay?" I saw what happened. His voice reminded me of Ethan's. He was probably around Ethan's age, too. "He just walked away," I said, rubbing furiously at my tear-stained cheek. "Why didn't anyone listen?" "Where's your stuff?" I paused mid-sob. "What?" "Your medicine." His voice was gentle. I don't don't have any. He gave me a quizzical look. Oh, do you need some? I stared at him. What are you, a pharmacist? No. The boy's eyes flitted from me to the crushed ASB and finally to Sal. I just want to go home, I said, sniveling into my sleeve. I just need to go, he interrupted. You're not from Torpor. No. Somnum, then? I don't know where that is. I scooted over to pick my helmet up off the ground, tucking it under my arm and sitting back on the sidewalk. I've never been to a city in my life. When I say the color drained out of his face faster than water in a sink, I mean it. What do you mean you don't live in a city? His voice was a harsh whisper. No, but I thought. He shook his head. Never mind. I studied him, an anomaly of emotion in a numb city. What's wrong with you? I asked finally. What's wrong with them? Oh, he contemplated Sal. Then he answered me with a question, like Aunt Beth sometimes did. What's the point of life? I opened my mouth to tell him I didn't have time for this, but he cut me off. Never mind. Doesn't matter what you think. People say it's to be happy. He sank to the ground beside me, tucking his arms around his knees. That didn't sound right to me, but I let him talk. So what's the point if you're not happy? He asked. I opened my mouth again, but he didn't let me answer. There isn't one. So they made it so anyone could be happy whenever they wanted, for as long as they wanted. If they can afford it, I guess, he added. I guess a better word for it would be complacent. Takes away all the negative feelings, you know. He swirled his finger around his ear. That's insane. Hey, they're doing what makes them happy, he said it bitterly. That is not happy. I swung my arm towards the crash mobile. I didn't say I agreed with it. Works pretty well for people who don't want a conscience anymore either, he said after a thought. Can't feel guilt. For a minute we sat on the sidewalk together, hating the blaze of traffic. But why? Better not to feel anything. Better for society if no one has to be sad or angry. That's what they think. What I used to think. Actually, he pulled his jacket tighter around himself. 2 months clean, he smiled sadly. I stared at him. Is he going to be okay? Who, the man? I don't know. The police will find him eventually. So there are police. Oh, yeah, we got police. And hospitals? Of course. I frowned. But nobody cares to call? He shrugged. Some do, some don't. They can't feel anything when they see something like that happen. So a lot of the urge to help is gone. Negative feelings, you know? More cars honked and swerved around the wreck. They could still do something if they wanted. They could choose to be. But they're lazy. Getting rid of their feelings just makes being lazy easier. Like you. I made my way over to Sal. Her handlebars were familiar in my hands. You're lazy. You didn't call. Don't got a phone. I glared at him. He shrugged again. Look, I'll find one, okay? I'll make sure someone takes care of him. I left him standing there on the sidewalk beside the wrinkled mess of a mobile. The city was a blur. Whether it was my tears or my speed that make it look that way, I don't know. Both. I climbed the gate. I left thinking how blind that lady was with her numb thoughts and her empty laugh. I had almost died in the city, and I was going to die when I got home. If not because of Aunt Beth, then, out of pure exhaustion. And I could never, never tell Winnie about it. And I would never, never go back. Winnie would never know what a city was like.